Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us to Chaser Takeaway video interview series, where we feature an expert or a subject matter or relevance for British Army and Defence. Obviously, these are conversations between two academics and experts and professionals. They don't reflect the views of the Army or Ministry of Defence or any institution. And today we are discussing the evolving nature of national intelligence and how it operated in the climate of war on terror, and now it's shifting geostrategic dynamics, where we talk about peer enemies and near peer enemies. Obviously, national intelligence always supported military operations, and particularly since 9/11 attacks, we have seen this as an important trend emerging to such a level that it went from collecting and analyzing to targeting to even operating drones in some cases, and particularly in the example of the United States. But now that we're discussing China and Russia and mega geostrategic shifts, actually, there is a question about whether we've been prepared to think that way, and whether imagining intelligence as supporting counterterrorism primarily has a curse. It enabled a lot. It clearly made our world safer, but has it actually created a weakness? We have David Oakley with us to discuss all these conversations. He served as an intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency, but also as a military officer with US Army, as a strategist and as an artillery officer, and currently a lecturer at the National Defense University. So a geek and an operator, and somebody who has seen the interaction of these two worlds in the field for a while. David, thank you so much for joining us. I'm just going to really start with actually your book, where you explore how the relationship between the CIA and Department of Defense evolved since the Cold War through War on Terror and to this day. What is it that led you to have a critical perspective on the relationship between national intelligence and military operations? And what are some of the key things you found that maybe were different when you were an intelligence officer or an army officer?
Hey, Zia, thank you very much for having me today. Yeah, so, you know, the way I came about my research, as you mentioned, I'm you know, a former CIA officer, currently, you know, still a military officer. And I was at a school called the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth. And one of the requirements was to do an operational level research project. And so while I was a CIA officer, I was always kind of, I always wondered about the relationship between the two organizations. And the reason why is, if you've ever worked in either of the two organizations, or both, I should say, they're very culturally different. And so, for example, the military is very much about, you know, processes. And, you know, the CIA, not so much so. You know, it's all about it depends. It's about flexibility. It's about, you know, adapting to the environment. And so I knew they had a shared lineage. And so I you know, got curious about exploring that shared lineage and how they became so different. And so my initial research for SAMS was really a good news story. And so I looked at the evolution of the relationship since roughly Desert Storm, and I highlighted a lot of the positives in the relationship. So for example, after Desert Storm, the CIA created the Office of Military Affairs. You started having national intelligence support teams, structures and capabilities to support the warfighter. And so it was a good news story. As I moved on into my doctoral research, I started thinking more, and my thought about it evolved. And so while I acknowledged and appreciated the benefits, I started thinking, you know, have we gone too far? Has the United States started to, you know, what I call in the book, quasi-subordination of national intelligence to the warfighter? And so from there, you know, I think for our discussion, four of the, I think, important points that I came to in the book are, many people talk about the 1990s in the United States as kind of the lost decade, that there wasn't much done. There was a reduction in defense spending. There was a reduction in intelligence spending. What I found was that decisions made in the 1990s, structural decisions, relationship decisions between the CIA and DOD, set the foundation for the post 9/11 relationship. And so I argue that although the war on terror would have forced the relationship to improve, it would have been much more painful without these decisions in the 90s. So that's my first one. My second one is these changes were part of an effort pushed by Congress and others to adapt after the Cold War and to focus more on intelligence support to the warfighter. And so there was a lot of congressional pressure to do this, and a lot of it stemmed from even before even before Desert Storm. So if you look back into the early 80s with the Goldwater Nichols, around the same time, there were individuals like Ike Skelton, who was a congressman from Missouri, pushing for a more of a role and a relationship between national intelligence and the military. One of the important aspects of, or the things I discovered that I think is relevant for today, is I started noticing through my research that we all define intelligence slightly different. And what I mean by that is, you know, some people I speak to, they will focus on intelligence, what I call in the book, intelligence for action. And so, you know, I was, they're looking for the, as one person told me, identifying the guy behind the door. Okay. You know, so to enable action is what I call it. But others will look at intelligence more from an understanding. And so understanding to inform policymakers. And I think that's very important, especially for today. And then finally, I think that this time frame that I look at in the relationship between the CIA and DOD is not just about intelligence, but I think it's about the broader militarization in the United States of foreign policy and other policy, a dependence on that we see on the Department of Defense.
Yeah, David, I think that point about a vision of intelligence as an enabler of the hard security and defense responses versus the role of intelligence as kind of scanning the horizon, making sense of the days before they happen. Obviously, it's impossible to forecast the future, but you do need people whose job is that strategic thinking, that strategic analysis, and paying attention to clues. And often felt like, if you look at the war on terror era, our immediate hard security response has been driven by meeting the challenge of jihadi violence, and whether it is in Afghanistan, Iraq, or globally, from a counterterrorism and counterinsurgency perspective. But even our military peers, like in US Army, in British Army, overall NATO, since particularly maybe 2014, maybe with the Ukraine question, even a bit before that, we have realized that actually, while this is a real threat, and you know how to deal with this to a certain extent in terms of the hard security responses, not so much so political, we have kind of taken our eyes off the ball with other challenges like Russia, like China, or adversaries that are peer enemies and near peer enemies. So if you think about intelligence beyond targeting, profiling individual terrorist suspects or terrorists, into developing networks for collection within some of these states, or analysis of those states, or reading the times, have we taken our eyes off the ball? And in other words, this different expectation from intelligence, has it ended up becoming a national liability that pushed us to adopt into what our adversaries are doing much later than actually could have done if we had stick to traditional role of intelligence rather than militarize it?
No, I think so. I mean, you know, I remember speaking to a friend of mine that was a senior leader, and it wasn't even on peer competition. He, you know, when I was asking this question during my research about, you know, what are the costs of focusing so much on counterterrorism or supporting the military? And he brought up the Arab Spring. He said, I can tell you why we missed the Arab Spring, because we were so focused on the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and counterterrorism. And I think this, you know, this recognition of kind of the broader trends, or the, you know, the flows of history, is one way to put it. I think when we get focused on the here and now, on more of a tactical type of mindset, we miss those big things. Dr. Greg Treverton used to be the National Intelligence Council chair. He has a great discussion, one of his books, between mysteries and puzzles. And he talks about puzzles as, you know, you get that secret information that's knowable to enable you to take an action. So, you know, the puzzle is, you know, where are the missiles located? Where is the terrorist head located? We identify that, we can now take action. A mystery, on the other hand, is there's not this secret information. It's more about broad understanding. And I think we've invested a lot, and we've gotten very good on puzzle solving, how to find information to take action. But I think at the cost of this broad understanding, understanding the mysteries and what might lie ahead.
And it seems to me, I mean, at this from as an outsider perspective, It's quite a relevant question because currently, for example, we're facing the question of the pandemic, right? And some of the media reports have suggested that the intelligence reports or even diplomatic cables from China already were signaling to the fact that the scope of this virus and its spread wasn't necessarily as being portrayed by China or worded by World Health Organization. But I think the current pandemic itself, for example, is a fascinating case study to think about an immediate development that is not necessarily a black swan. It wasn't every national security assessment. I think it was Frank Hoffman who said this is more like a pink flamenco rather than a black swan. This was coming, but it did happen. But I think it poses a lot of questions on both the current intelligence operation frameworks and orientations, because this is a global challenge now that perhaps even those of us who spoke about this as a possibility didn't necessarily foresee to the depth of it. And then also the future of intelligence orientation. I mean, some people are already arguing that, for example, the pandemic is going to force US government and DOD to see the home domain as a fundamental aspect of their work and maybe roll back some of the global presence or orientations and some of the military reforms too. How would that impact current intelligence and future intelligence? I mean, the pandemic and the possibility of such pandemics emerging again shortly.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, going back through like the National Intelligence Council writings and even some in the UK, people have been talking about pandemics for a while. I mean, the United States had its first, pandemic influenza plan, I believe in like 2006. Yeah. And so I think people have seen this on the horizon. With that said, although we knew it was a possibility, I don't think we understood the repercussions, and there wasn't a lot of discussion between those who understood as a possibility and those who had a role in preparing for that possibility. I think what a lot of that boils down to, at least in the United States, we've had this very kind of narrow definition of security. And this is something scholars have talked about for a long time. You know, what is security? And I think in the United States, we look at security from, you know, although we've had homeland security and stuff like that, but even homeland security was developed because of terrorism. Most of it has been focused on protecting from an adversary, whether it's a state or non-state actor. I think what the pandemic raises in my mind is what is really more of a threat to the livelihood, the well-being of a nation, terrorism or a pandemic, which you look at the current one, in the United States, over 1 million infected, over 60,000 dead. You look at businesses, you look at all the effects of this. I would argue that the pandemic is much more of a security threat to the United States and its future. Now, I want to be cautious because usually in the United States, when you say security, we normally say, okay, the solution is the Department of Defense. And this ties back to my book a little bit. Just because it's a security issue does not mean the Department of Defense is the solution. I think, you know, just as we've militarized our foreign policy, we run the risk of militarizing our response to pandemics and stuff. So instead of, I get really a little nervous whenever I see former generals like General Honore on CNN, interviewing them, because I think in the Americans' mind, the solution is, hey, let's establish a joint task force and let's send the military out and deploy this. And I don't think that's the right answer. Military has a role. There's a lot of capabilities the military can support, but there's individuals who understand and are better postured to understand what the solution is in something like this. And so, you know, my argument is instead of, you know, saying, okay, let's militarize this solution, why don't we expand our concept of security and invest more in HHS, invest more in, you know, Department of State, because there is, you know, the other thing this pandemic has brought up is this just isn't, as much as we'd like to close down the borders, you know, as policy, this is an international phenomenon, and it's we have to have a international response to it, and we have to ensure that those partnerships are in place, the planning is in place.
Yeah. And David, I think even in this pandemic episode, right? So there is still that question of, okay, you have the deep tells, the collectors, the input coming from all sorts of directions. But in the end of the day, how they're analyzed, put together, communicated to policymakers, and what they do with that information kind of is the main challenge. I mean, a few people have written articles arguing that the responses to pandemic reflects an intelligence failure, but if intelligence is already there, is this really an intelligence failure, or is this actually a policy failure? But it seems to me, currently, given the fact that we have so much open source information, right, we're not really suffering from lack of information. On top of that, you have the signals intelligence or all sorts of communication capabilities within the 5-5 communities, right? US is advanced and the UK and our partners in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand, etc. On top of that, the human intelligence aspect of it, which again, we give this group of countries in 5-5's superb network or people are happy to or willing to share information. But when you think about the overflow of all of this, all the information that comes into the DC, to London, to Paris, and et cetera, is technological developments like artificial intelligence going to play a better role in us sifting through some of this intelligence gathering? Or is it going to be more, again, back to individuals who are able to draw from all of these, but somehow we're helping them as analysts to think beyond kind of those black swan paradigm, pay attention to pink flamingos, and actually see, put the dots together? Or is it going to be new structures, right? I realize my shadow is expanding because somehow London has started to give up on the sunshine in the middle of this conversation. Or is the answer a new structure, right? Do we need to create new entities, new bodies, or do we demolish 10, 15, 20 intelligence agencies or intelligence routes countries in Firefly's community have? Or are we just better off living it as where things are? It's just that we focus on individuals in this process.
So, you know, I'll begin because I think you raised an important question. In my mind, the difference between collection and analysis. And so I've been reading a lot of, well, I'll begin with that, you know, the intelligence failure. I don't see it, if from what I'm reading, this has been a warning. I don't really see it as an intelligence failure.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like people were aware. Now, I think, you know, to the degree that they were aware and the degree they were warning, it will take some time before we know that. But back to the analysis and collection. You know, to me, I think I was never an analyst, but it seems to me, and this is back to Treverton's Puzzles and Mysteries, if we really want to generate intelligence for understanding, if we really want to know the mysteries, we have to strengthen the relationship between the analyst and the policymaker. We have to, you know, the analyst has to help the policymaker understand not an issue, but how that issue rests and nests with the broader world and other issues.
Yeah.
And so we've done a lot of, within the US, we've done a lot of increasing the relationship between the collectors and the analyst. And you look at the CIA and their, the way they've restructured has focused on that. But although that's helpful, I think, for taking action, I don't know if it's as helpful for informing policymakers, creating this understanding for policymakers. And so that's one thing. When I look at, you know, I've been reading some articles on the role of human intelligence. I'm very cautious because whenever I think of, and this goes back to to the mention of the difference in how people perceive intelligence. From my experience at the CIA was in the director of operations. And I was always taught that, you know, intelligence, you know, to deem something intelligence, it had to be clandestinely acquired. And so what that means is you don't send out, you know, finite resources, human resources, to collect information that you can get in the open, right? You don't want case officers out taking polls or, you know, going out and asking, risking their lives to you know, get, or risking their assets lives to collect information that's open source.
You mean, okay. Jack Ryan is not a real character? Is that right?
So, the ultimate operator geek. Yeah. But for the collectors, you know, we don't want to change, you know, intelligence needs to be very narrow for the human, right? It's information that cannot be sought in the open. You need that clandestine capability. Now, for the analyst, though, the analyst needs information that's not only secrets, but that's open source, that's in the media, that's collected from different places. So their definition of intelligence will be, in my view, different, because their purpose they're serving is different. And that definition of intelligence is guiding that purpose. regarding structure, what I fear, and I think an example would be our response to terrorism in the United States. We created a lot of structure, and they've done some great work. Stuff like the National Counterterrorism Center stuff has done some great work. But it does become problematic that when we adjust our structures to respond to the latest issue or the latest flavor, and we get hyper-focused on that. I think what I would encourage is, maybe we need to think more of a breadth of expertise collectively working together to generate this understanding among like analysts, instead of creating individual stovepipes. So I'll use it for example, right now, one of the issues in the House is there's a bill out to create a climate center in the intelligence community. And I always think to myself, I think it's positive that the analysts, again, we don't want human collectors going out collecting, climate samples or, climate data. But I think it's great that the analysts are considering it, but I don't think it should be stovepipe. I mean, I think this expertise and this knowledge should be spread out, because the way it affects one region will if it leads to war, if it leads to, a movement, migration of people in one region, it's going to be quite different than in the other. So you need this broad knowledge and understanding across the different areas. And that is much different than how it might affect the homeland. But I think you don't create a center then. You then spread out this talent in the organizations that have that understanding. As for the technology question, I haven't really researched AI and technology, but I do read about it. And it seems to me when you have the data out there doubling every 2 years, that you need to have some AI support to the analyst to go through the information, because there's so much information overload, yeah, right? And so you need that technological help, but you still have to depend on the analyst. And so while I think it's good to have, like in the United States, we have something called AIM, which is an initiative within the intelligence community to enable the analyst, you still have to depend on the analyst. I mean, you still have to train analysts who are broad thinking and understand not just their issue, but how their issue is in relationship to other issues. And part of that, it's interesting. I always talk to my, most of my students are practitioners. Well, I should say all of my students are practitioners. And one of the things we always speak about is we discuss understanding the environment. And we became very good about appreciating, or better, I shouldn't say very good, but we became better about appreciating the environment when it comes to the other. And so, we talk about socioeconomic and the other. We aren't very good yet at analyzing ourselves.
Yeah.
And understanding how we ourselves, our institutions, our organizations, our interests affect the way we see the problem and the possibilities in responding to the problem.
Yeah. Definitely. I think half of interpretation is the object you're studying. The remaining half is actually you, what questions you're asking, what methods you're deploying, what insights you're inferring to. It's a lot about you as much as it's a lot the object. Thank you so much, David. This has been a very rich conversation. Your book is full of extremely fascinating nuggets of insights, because it draws from a lot of interviews with people with hands-on experience of both military operations and intelligence operations since Cold War and in War on Terror. I think you raised very important questions about this different expectation from intelligence as enabling operations and tactical needs versus providing the strategic questions and challenge, and sometimes challenging the assumptions and the direction of the politics and political responses. I think our conversations in Europe that are highly relevant for us. And thank you so much for your time. And thanks to everybody who watched us. And if you want to watch more videos like that, do check out www.chaser.org.uk on our website. Thank you so much, David.
Hey, thanks, Z. I really appreciate it.